Thanks for listening, and thanks, members, for supporting KBOO Portland, your community radio station at 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59. Coming up at 11 on Stage and Studio, host DeMay Roberts celebrates theater sound design with veteran Portland sound designer Jen Raynack. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews Portland abstract painter Judy Cook about Portland in the 1960s and 1970s, design and architecture, and her method idea of solving a painting like a problem. After this announcement, we will go to Stage and Studio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. Hosted by Colorado-based Yonder Mountain String Band, this year's festival includes bands such as Grinsky's Bluegrass, the infamous String Dusters, Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, Sook Twins, and more. There will also be a late-night stage, an early-morning Cascadia stage, and daytime movies and seminars. Again, that's the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm DeMay Roberts, Stage and Studio. You're listening to one of many compositions by Jen Raynack. She's been a longtime veteran Portland theater sound designer. Since the 90s, she's created nuanced, intricate, and complex sound designs for countless Portland theater companies. Raynack carved out a career for herself at a time when sound design wasn't a high priority for many stages. Now, it's essential. I recorded her on location at my radio documentary class in April, last spring term at Mount Hood Community College's Integrated Media Program. I'm DeMay Roberts, Stage and Studio, and my guest today is Jen Raynack, who is probably the most long-term veteran sound designer in Portland. I've heard your sound designs for years, probably like 20 years. I don't know if
about
you go 20 back.
Years, yeah.
Yeah, so you do go back that far. I wasn't imagining that. Would you tell us first off just a little bit about your background? You know, how did you get into sound design?
I was a musician starting when I was very small. I started piano lessons at 4, and that's always been really a part of my life, music in general. And then my dad was an electronics nerd, so he taught me how to solder when I was a kid, and we were always messing around with making recordings of things, and it was a natural transition into sound design.
How old were you when you were learning how to solder with your dad?
Probably 7 or 8. 7, I would imagine, somewhere in there.
Yeah. That's not that usual, right?
Right. Yeah, I had a good dad.
What did your dad do?
He was a milk tester. He had a chemistry degree, and he tested milk at farms, but he just had an interest in electronics and robotics, as primitive as they were at the time. But he's now an IT guy.
So did you start doing sound then at that point or all your life?
I wasn't really doing sound back then. There wasn't a lot of opportunity. I grew up in a really rural area in Vermont. But as soon as I got to college, I created my own major called Music for Theater and Dance. And I was basically doing a sound design degree before anybody was offering one.
Wow. What college was that?
Wells College in upstate New York.
What did you do for that?
A lot of composition classes, a lot of music theory classes, but then also directing classes, acting classes, choreography classes, dance classes, marketing classes, all kinds of stuff related to the field in general.
So I guess what were some of your first productions? Do you remember?
Oh my gosh. We did a show called Taps. And I had a Casio keyboard and a SM58, and I sat off stage right and created a live soundscape for a theater performance. And we probably did 12 shows of it or something. But I was composing from like weird sounds I could make with my mouth or tapping the microphone on things or creating feedback.
That sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
It was. Yeah. It sure was, yeah.
What brought you to Portland?
It was pretty. I was living in Colorado, and I drove out here in April of 94, and it was the prettiest place I'd ever seen. You guys know, it looks great here in April. And then 8 months later, I put everything I owned into my truck and moved here, and I haven't left.
I think you've worked in practically every theater company. It seems like, from my outside perspective, you have worked with a lot of theater and dance companies.
Yeah.
What started you in that? Because that didn't sound like that was actually your intention to do sound design.
It kind of was. Before I moved to Portland, I'd worked at a couple of theaters in the Northeast. And I learned about the job of resident sound designer. So it was a target for me. And I think it was 4 or maybe 5 years after I moved here when I became the resident sound designer at PCS.
At Portland Center Stage.
At Portland Center Stage, yeah. I started out in their paint department because that's where I could get in. And then I volunteered to work with their sound designers, and I volunteered to do some engineering for them. And then they offered me a full season, and they offered me the resident sound design job.
And now who do you work for?
I work for Portland's 5 Centers for the Arts, PCPA. I am the technician in the Winningstad Theater, so I'm the department head for carpentry, sound, props, electrics, and fly.
But you're also doing Oregon Children's Theater too, right?
They're the client in the room right now.
Oh, so whoever is in there, you do the sound design for them?
Not necessarily sound design. I could be doing lighting as well, or it depends on what the client's needs are. Sometimes I'm the only person in there, and it's a lecture. So I design some lighting and make the sound go and put out some stairs and a lectern and adjust the curtains or whatever.
Well, it sounds like you are, you know, Jill of all trades, right? And that's kind of what you need to be when you are somebody who works in sound design, I think.
Absolutely.
And so what is it about sound design that you love?
It's really being able to create emotional content for the audience, and being able to influence the audience to learn, to teach them what they need to know about the play in a way that is so deep. You know, it's like lizard brain stuff happening back there when you play some music or a sound cue. It's not the same as the words coming in.
Well, we heard some of your pieces, like this chicken karaoke. Can you tell us the backstory of that and how you did that?
Absolutely. That was for Nobody Here But Us Chickens with Third Rail Repertory Theater. The play itself dealt with some really heavy issues, but it was a comedy. So we wanted to let the audience know that they were allowed to laugh, even though the subject material was really heavy, that it was okay for the audience to laugh during the show. So we picked out some really recognizable tunes, and I recorded these chicken karaoke versions with the cast. I recorded small groups, usually 3 or 4 people at a time. The cast and then other members of the company, the lighting designer was in there somewhere, and I just let them go free and do whatever they wanted to do, and we created some great harmonies and little cackly things otherwise, but they're all just making chicken noises. There's no words to this, so they're saying, "I can see clearly now, the rain has gone, but it's just bok, 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 bok."
And so that sounded like a really great layered piece. Another one that I thought was more serious, which was the spoken word collage that you did for Precious Little, which was a very serious play.
Yeah.
And you had I saw it and heard it, and it really stood out that you had multiple monitors set up around the small theater, but you also had an actress live saying some of the words too. How did you time that all out?
I worked with Joanne Johnson, the director, and she and I sort of we drew the outlines of the painting that we wanted. And then I made recordings of Christy Bigelow, who is the actor on stage. And I think I was running usually 4 tracks of voiceover at one time out of different speakers with different content in them. And then Joanne and Christy and I would work together to find, this really needs to be about 4 or 5 seconds shorter. So I'd go in and slice out some of the gaps in between some of the things, or we'd really like this to stick out a little more. So I'd overlap where I would line up where two different speakers had the same content so that you would hear it together, which would make it stand out more. And then Christy was able to play alongside of that and emphasize other things.
She said that I was like, totally, they didn't, but I was like, no. I know not even I didn't think about. She was like, if you don't, I'm gonna, even though we were like, anyway, seriously, tell her to do what did you, what did she,
that she said, he said that I
did you, what is the process like? Like, how long do you take for each sound design and each production? I mean, what do you go through?
I'm a pretty intuitive sound designer, which means that I do a lot, I read the play a lot months before the production ever happens, but I don't tend to do too much work on it between then and the first rehearsal. And then I go to rehearsal all the time. Go to rehearsal, hear the tempo of the scenes, hear the pacing, hear what emotional quality the actors are bringing to things. And then I start dropping cues in as soon as I have them, which could be 2-3 days into rehearsal. I'll start playing stuff, first in my headphones and then in the room, just to start connecting that to the actors. Then I try to have everything done before we head into tech so that it goes smoothly during tech.
And so what is the most challenging sound design that you've ever done?
The one that caused me to take a one-year sabbatical, you mean?
Oh, yes, I want to hear about that one.
It was How to Disappear Completely and Never Be Found at Portland Center Stage. It was so hard. I was running 16 tracks of audio, and the only time the room was silent from when the doors opened a half an hour before the show started until the play was over was about the last 8 seconds. So I had up to 16 tracks of audio running for almost 3 hours, and that creating that content, and it was just constant, like sometimes it was subliminal sort of noise or low frequency just discomfort, and sometimes it was motivational cues, the phone would ring or something, but it was layered, and I had 16 speakers around the room, so discrete placement, discrete content, lots of programming time, tons of programming time, tons of compositional time. I was doing voiceover recordings of the actors and stretching them out to turn them into like an organ music almost, you know, and composing with stretched out versions of the actors' words. It was magical and hard, and I took a year off after that.
It was that hard though, huh?
It made me not want to do it again for a little while.
Wow, because it was like you climbed a mountain and you needed to rest?
Exactly, yeah. Wow.
Well, you're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts talking with veteran sound designer Jen Reinach. And we're on location at Mount Hood Community College's Integrated Media Program. And I have some students here who have some questions. Karen, you want to come up here and ask a question?
As the interview was going, I was like, well, and what about? But I do have one question to ask you. And is obviously you know music, which is very important. You played the piano when you were little. But and you know the techniques. But I want to know, with the director, how much creativity is there? So you said you read the script and then you watched the rehearsal. So it's not always the director saying, I want you to put this song or this song. You give her or him ideas that you come up with, right?
Yeah, now I do. When I was just starting out, I had to be a little less selective of projects because it was paying the bills and I was new and not everybody knew me back then. I get to be a little bit more selective now, 20 years later, and choose projects that allow me that freedom. That when I talk with the director before I accept a project, to be able to say, just so you know, I don't want to like be handed a stack of CDs and play what you want me to play. That doesn't interest me. But if you would like someone who's invested and going to do some compositional work and going to talk with you throughout the process and collaborate with you and create this emotional environment, let's work together.
It wouldn't interest you if it was, give me this music, put me this music, or...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's gone. That was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now you get to create. That's so great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we have another question here. Corey?
Do you ever find that when you're working on a show that the director will actually have you give the actors direction as a sound designer? Like, do you get the do you ever have to go and speak to the actors about what you're doing in order to make sure that the show runs smoothly?
I always try to filter it either through the director or the stage manager, depending on what the situation is that we're in. But yes, the short answer is yes, that I am looking at the play from a different perspective than the performer or the director or even the playwright. I've worked on new plays before. And I, again, in a respectful way, so respecting the hierarchy, of course, I'm not shy to give an opinion about something, to say, you know, I'm the way I'm seeing this, it feels like it needs to be a little slower for this to hit home here. And if the director may say, hey, can you go talk to the actors about that and tell them what you're thinking? So yeah, it does happen. I never just will walk up to the actors and give them a note. That's kind of crummy. But yeah, I think, again, that the having done this for so long, I'm respected. So my people want to hear my voice, and I don't take projects where they don't want to hear my voice.
Another question? Why don't you come up here? And this one's from Brent.
So, I mean, going live like that, I guess there's not a lot of room for mistakes. But have you ever made a big mistake in live, and what was it?
Mistake in what?
Mistake,
mixing a show?
Like mixing a show live, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure I have. There's always little tiny ones, like the first consonant of the show is missing because I forgot to unmute the master. I like hit the individual mic and they say, can you believe it? And then all the audience hears is, and you believe it? Because like the first sound didn't come out and I saw it and hit the button. Of course, yeah, there's little ones all the time. It's, can't think of a huge one. I'm sure it's happened.
The big problem would be if you played the wrong sound, like the wrong cue.
Oh yeah, back in the olden days, in the super olden days, and I didn't get fired for this, which was probably kind of them, but I was running a show on reel-to-reel. This was 1991, I guess, at Stage West, maybe, Springfield, Massachusetts. Company's not around anymore. But it was the kind of thing where everything was on reel-to-reel except for the pre-show announcements, which were on cassette for some reason. And then I had to move things around on the console and repatch things, and the birds came out of the toilet speaker.
Well, that's a happy toilet, yeah. I think. Yeah.
But that kind of thing happened all the time back in those days, because you were always unplugging things and plugging other things back in and turning knobs. And now it's all digital, so we don't have to worry about that technical part of it.
Yeah, once it's programmed, it runs smooth.
Yeah, exactly.
Does it run on its own?
Oh no, cues. Stage manager calls cues when I'm mixing, though. So I'm mixing Schoolhouse Rock Live.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It's six performers, five high school kids and one adult, and we're doing 12 shows a week, Oregon Children's Theater in the Winningstad Theater. It's an hour long, and I'm mixing it live, and I have a digital console, and I haven't programmed a single scene so fast that I'm just using my hands. There's a three-piece band, the six wireless microphones, and I'm just moving stuff up and down because there's someone singing backup in a song, and then they have one line, and then another person has a line. Interjections, show excitement, hey, emotion, rah. You know, there's all these little things, and you just have to pop the one microphone up at a time. And 12 shows a week. Man, sometimes at 9:45 on a Wednesday morning, I'm like, oh, right, that line. You know, and it's not as loud as it should have been or whatever. But to even further answer your question, Brent, something that's important in that live situation is to be able to keep moving. You can't let whatever just happened make you paralyze you. Just like if you were playing on a sports team, you know, whatever, anything else, if you make an error, you have to keep moving. It's happening right now. That show's going to go on. So I'm sure that I made some horrible mistakes, but I can't dwell on them. I have to know what I did and not do it again, but keep going.
That's kind of a good lesson in life in general, huh? One of the things I actually remember Schoolhouse Rock, you know, and one of my favorite songs is Conjunction, Junction, yep. What's your function?
That's in our show.
12 times a week.
I want to see that. And it's probably driving you crazy. That's one of the things. When I'm doing mixes, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night going, I still hear that song. Do you get that too?
Absolutely. I find country music is a really good, like, ear wash, brainwash. for show tunes.
Really, any favorite country song?
Just whatever comes on the radio.
That really gets rid of it, huh?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because it's so hooky. There's so many, it's like hook after hook after hook. So it'll just dig in there and rinse out whatever the show tune is.
I try Sesame Street, that song, you know?
Sure.
So one of the things I'm noticing, and I'd really like to talk to you about your philosophy of sound design, because lately it seems like more theaters and dance are turning up the volume louder and louder, and that there's wall-to-wall music throughout the whole thing, that there isn't really like spoken word. That there's a sense of underscoring every single thing and every single actor's scenes. What do you think about that?
I think for the right project, it can work well, but I don't think it's right for every project. What I'm mixing right now, I'm mixing this show pretty loud. It's not uncomfortable to me, but it's a rock show. It's loud. It's going to be loud the whole time. I got a drummer, so that's going to be loud. If I'm doing intimate, quiet play in a small theater, maybe if the piece demands it, maybe there will be underscoring throughout. It's not, nobody comes to theater to hear the sound design. Like, it has to support the play. It has to be about the story. And if my work is not helping, it needs to go.
Questions? Anyone? Fabio.
Thank you for that. This is not related to what you're saying. I wish I could do a follow-up on that, because that was very interesting. But my question is, I know you touched on your background. I was wondering if any specific events or people that influenced you, made you want to get into this field?
Sure. I had a really fantastic college professor. There was only one theater teacher at my college, a very small school, and she had been a equity stage manager and a designer and a performer, and she didn't quite know what to do with me, but she was really supportive and let me do a lot of weird stuff. Like I said, the Casio keyboard and the one microphone sitting backstage making mouth noises. And then just in general, learning about, I was working as an electrician at Studio Arena Theater in Buffalo and learned there that there was such a job as resident sound designer. And I'm sorry, I can't remember that man's name, but he was lovely. And that's when I decided that that's what I wanted to do for my job. And then actually right in between there, Chuck Hatcher, I worked with at the Hangar Theater in Ithaca, New York. It was a similar situation, really compressed though, from PCS, where I volunteered on the first show as a dresser. It was just a summer season, and they hired me to design their fifth show. And Chuck Hatcher was the guy who could not do that fifth show, and he really taught me about crafting sound when you have more than a couple of speakers. It was my first time in a bigger theater. Christine Chalfant was in that production, and she won the Tony the next year. You know, they were well-funded. It was a whole bunch of people coming up from New York and working there. And so he really taught me how to think dimensionally. So, yeah.
What's your advice? Everybody here's a part of a two-year program, and they're getting their degrees. This is their last class, basically, and they'll be going off in different parts of the world or staying here in Portland. But what's your advice for, I guess job prospects for types of sound design or working in sound? What's your advice to young people?
I would say learn as much as you can, meet as many people as you can. It's the same advice you're going to get from everyone else, unfortunately. I'm not sure. I am a generalist, and I benefit from being a generalist. I can mix a live show or make a voiceover recording, or I'm not great at mastering multi-track recordings, but I have done it, and I can do it, and I know who to ask for help with it. But if you've found something that you love, just keep doing it and talk to people about it and read about it and look around, because it's so much more fun to do something that you like doing.
Do you have your own projects that you work on?
Occasionally. Well, I have some weird stuff. Like, I host a website with hopefully every theater production in Portland listed on it, and also a database of technicians. So, yeah, I dork around with that sort of stuff. I don't really do sound projects for fun, since I do so much of it at work.
What do you do for fun?
I like bowling. I like working in my garden. I like wearing funny socks and shoes. yeah, socializing. I don't know. Nothing unusual, I don't think.
We can take another question. Anybody have any questions? One final question from Andrea.
So Demay was mentioning it to us that you don't have a phone. How do you do it to communicate with you know, with your
or cell phone.
Yeah. How do you communicate? Is it hard for you since you don't have a cell phone, or how do you?
Yeah. How do they reach you when they say, Jen, this isn't right. What's going on?
Hopefully, I've set it up so that doesn't happen. I mean, my day job, I'm supposed to get all of my schedule at least 24 hours in advance, mm-hmm. and I'm constantly checking my email. I have two computers at home, and I have an iPad that I carry around and a computer at work, and I'm always checking email. And if someone calls my home phone, it sends a voicemail to my email. Oh. So I get messages. I just don't have to. I can deal with them at my convenience instead of having to drop everything and answer someone's question. Hopefully I've done everything beforehand so that there aren't any emergencies.
I'm kind of the same way. I hate answering the phone, and it's because I work in sound. Do you think there's a correlation there?
Maybe. I also get really distracted talking on the phone. It's really hard for me. Someone's doing this over here, and I'm like, ooh, squirrel.
Well, Jen Raynek, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for coming to our class here at Mount Hood Community College. Thank you.
That was veteran sound designer and composer Jen Raynek. You can find out more about her on stageandstudio.org, where I'll have some photos and links to the podcast of this interview. Before we go today, some announcements about some upcoming events in Portland. Check out Coho's next Summerfest offerings. On July 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, it's The Dissenter's Handbook, a collection of riotous tales by Dario Fo, and that's directed by Samantha Vandemerva of Shaking the Tree Theater, and starring acclaimed actor Matthew Carrigan. And the next one after that at Coho Summerfest offering is 9th through the 12th, and it's called Drowned Horse Tavern, a sea shanty cabaret. That's by Portland Experimental Theater Ensemble, Pete. That also sounds like unusual fare. And all shows are at Coho Productions, located at Coho Theater for their Coho Summerfest. That address is 2257 Northwest Raleigh Street in Portland. And you can find out more info on that at Coho Productions.org. On July 12th at noon, 4 p.m. and 8 p.m., the Hearth Collective presents three stage readings from the Kilroy's List. That's a list of underproduced female-identified plays. It's hosted by Portland Center Stage with support from the Jaw Playwrights Festival. All three readings are at the Ellen By Studio, at the Girding Theater, at Portland Center Stage. That's located at 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. The plays at the Hearth Collective are as follows. July 12th at noon, I Enter the Valley by Deepika Guha, and that's directed by Olga Sanchez. At 4 p.m., the play is Bliss or Emily's Post is Dead by Jamie Brandley, and that's directed by Jill Westerby. And the final stage reading of the play is at 8 p.m., and that's The Oregon Trail by Becca Brunstetter, directed by Megan Kate Ward. All shows are free, and you can find out more info about all three of these readings on July 12th at thehearthcollective.com. On July 5th at noon, Portland 5's Summer Arts on Main Street showcases Michelle Fuji and Toru Watanabe, the founders of Unit Sozo, Portland's premier taiko and Japanese dance group. The show is free and open to all ages and takes place on Southwest Main Street between Broadway and Park, and that's next to the Schnitzer Concert Hall. That free show of Unit Sozo is July 15th at noon to 1 p.m. And finally, Anon It Moves presents Shakespeare's Cymbeline in a female-driven version of the play on July 17th through August 8th, Thursday through Sundays at 7:30 p.m. All shows are at Milagro Theater, that's located at 525 Southeast Stark in Portland. For more info, visit anonitmoves.org or call them at their box office at 503-686-0294. That's it for Stage and Studio. I have photos and links and podcasts of this interview on stageandstudio.org. And you can also locate us on facebook.com/stage_N_studio or tweet me with your events at @StageNStudio. Till next time, I'm Demi Roberts. Let's go out with more of that chicken song composed and designed by Jen Raynek.
You're tuned to KBOO Community Radio 90.7. Coming up next on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews Portland abstract painter Judy Cook about Portland in the 1960s and 1970s, design and architecture, and her method idea of solving a painting like a problem. First, an important message.
Tune in to KBOO for the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Tuesday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th, from noon to 10 p.m. We'll be broadcasting live from the festival. Oregon community media stations in Ashland, Astoria, Bend, Cottage Grove, Newport, Salem, and Warm Springs will also be carrying the festival, as well as KBOO in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis. So tune in July 2nd through the 5th, noon to 10 p.m., for the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival on Oregon Community Media and your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol's silver screen can't tell him apart at all.